The opinions expressed on Inside the Black Box do not reflect those of WREK Radio or the Georgia Institute of Technology.
I live on a street near the university. Are you getting this, kid? Don't know if I did.
Tones bring us on.
Dulcet is not the adjective I would have used for our own Ed Greco, better known as Fat Daddy Sorghum. You like to sing the song, don't you?
Husky? Was that a husky?
Oh,
like an angel with a pack-a-day habit.
Oh, okay. That's right.
All right, well, aside from Ed's audition here live on the air, welcome to Inside the Black Box, a weekly program on science and technology, and I have no windscreen in front of my microphone, so if I pop during the thing, too bad. I'm Pete Ludovis, and as you heard previously, I am here with my lovely co-host, Ed Greco from the School of Physics, and Jennifer Levy from, I want to say biology, but actually, what is your official title here? It's very fancy. Lab Coordinator Extraordinaire?
No.
No.
That's not it.
Lab Coordinator, I don't think so.
But don't you like run all, aren't you in charge of all the labs in the Clough Undergraduate
Learning College? No, that's not my job.
And the director of the Urban Honeybee Project here.
That is my job.
Okay.
But yeah, integrated science curriculum coordinator. See? Is my technical title.
Okay, that's fancy. Are you saying that's not fancy?
It's that fancier.
It's fancy, but it's not. Yeah.
Okay.
It's different.
I will agree with that.
It's special. I think that position was created for Jennifer.
That's right.
To do her magic.
No.
Right. All right, well, the title of today's program is Making Cities Friendlier, and our guest is Cleo, I'm going to get this right, Andrus, right?
That's right.
Okay, who is currently an assistant professor in urban analytics. Is that the way to describe it?
I'm a joint hire in city and regional planning and interactive computing. So they have joint custody of me.
Oh, okay. So did a divorce have to occur before this happened?
Yeah, but it's
did you get
right.
two holidays?
Two offices, maybe.
I have more than two offices.
Look at that.
Two Christmases.
Wow.
Two
so
bedrooms.
There it is. The benefit of a joint custody agreement between schools here at Georgia Tech.
They get along. They get along.
Yeah, but so, it's tough because you don't know if you left your backpack at one or the other.
It's really rough.
This reminds me of one of my colleagues who has a couple offices, but he makes sure one of his offices has nothing in it but an espresso machine. He has an espresso machine in every office because he can't live without it. Some kind of caffeine addiction. But Cleo did her – now, this is a very interesting pedigree. Bachelor of Arts in American Studies at Boston University, a Master's of Science in Geography from the University of South Carolina, and a PhD in Urban Information Systems from MIT. Was schizophrenia involved at that choice, or was this a purposeful, systematic choice?
Pete, are you dissing your alma mater?
No, I'm not dissing. No. So to me, this is really cool for people to do such a diverse academic track.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm wondering, what was the decision? What was the decision process behind that?
Well, at Boston University, I sort of made my own major. You were allowed to do that there. So I actually had a minor in geography. And so that's where I learned about GIS. And they ran out of GIS classes for me to take there. And GIS stands for Geographic Information Systems.
Thank you for that.
No problem. So I ended up taking the graduate level classes, and they were super nice to let me in. I also had some friends to buy me beer, which was another reason to take grad classes as an undergrad.
It's an extra bonus.
Yeah.
That's right.
I'm just kidding. I didn't drink in college.
Oh, it's okay. You're at Georgia Tech, the drinking school with an engineering program.
So I learned
the opinions expressed on Inside the Black Box.
Oh, that's right. We didn't do the. Did we do the
disclaimer.
Oh, okay.
Oh, okay.
Then
there
we're covered.
We're covered.
We're covered. We're liability.
Speak power to truth. There we go.
So I learned about geographic information systems there, and then I was specializing in more into data mining in my master's degree, and I love data mining. Now it has a much fancier term. Data mining has fancier terms these days.
What are the fancy terms for data mining?
Well, they do call it more pattern recognition, machine learning, deep learning.
Deep learning, okay. That's my favorite.
Yeah, and I'm sure a lot of people would argue that deep learning is much more than data mining, but I think that they're all fruit in the same basket.
But I think you have to say deep learning with a very low voice. Deep learning. like, what was it, Al Franken, the bit he used to do? Deep, no, Something Thoughts. He used to do a funny...
Deep Thoughts.
Deep, yeah, thought. Deep Thoughts, something like that.
Jack Candy. Jack Candy.
Wow. So, and then before you came here, though, you were on the faculty at Penn State.
I was there for 5 years.
And you had a site called Friendly Cities.
I had a lab called Friendly Cities.
Okay. And it's a great website, which I did visit, which I thought was really cool. So can you tell us a little bit about that lab?
Yes. So Friendly Cities Lab was a lab under the GeoVista Center at Penn State in the Department of Geography. And we had a lot of great grad students and undergraduates working there. And Friendly Cities is like social cities. But the term social was really overused, so we wanted to make it more like Friendly Cities. And my favorite TV show has always been Sesame Street. And that was one reason why we wanted to make Friendly Cities. Our tagline for the lab is data-driven love for community. And so we want to make communities and cities better using some large data sets. And that's why I'm here as a part of the Urban Analytics team.
Very cool.
Wow.
Is it true that there is now an actual Sesame Street in New York City?
I did hear that.
Okay, I need to look this up.
That's right. Google Maps can get you there now.
We use some analytics and figure it out.
Exactly. Yeah. But being in Atlanta is really great because I loved living in State College, but it was a tiny town and it was really well run. The buses ran on time. The snow plows were perfect. There's a very, very safe place to live. And so we didn't have as many problems to solve there.
Traffic? No traffic?
No traffic.
Oh. Except on football game days, right? I've been there. It was a little ugly.
If you stay off the two roads.
Right, that sort of lead to the stadium, then you're probably okay.
Yes. We only have two roads in State College, but if you stay off both of those, then you're fine.
Okay. I did find it, so State College, Pennsylvania, when I went there for a conference, was the only place where you actually had to call a cab from the airport. So I got out, expected seeing a taxi line, and people, you got to call one, dude. So
we only have two taxis there.
Now, is that two taxis or two taxi companies?
Two taxis.
Aaron and Jeff.
It's a two taxi town, Pete.
Well, apparently they were on some kind of break when I went there many, many years ago.
We just got Uber and Lyft there very recently. Oh, so cool. They know exactly when the couple of flights come in each day. And so they're usually waiting.
Oh, that seems about right. There were not a great variety of flights available to get in there.
Yes, that is true.
So basically, you came here to Georgia Tech to step up the challenge of making cities friendlier, right?
She got off the plane and she was like, oh my God, I've got so much work to do.
And by the way, you're absolutely positively brand new, right?
Oh,
you started this fall.
I am brand new, yes.
Okay. And how are things going so far?
Everything is wonderful here.
Okay.
I absolutely love it.
Now, when we
Why
were talking
are you all laughing?
Before the program,
she
kind of had
so
a glazed
new.
Look
you're
on
so
her face
new.
Like, oh my God, I don't know what I'm going to do. Is Atlanta a friendly city?
In some ways.
We have friendly neighborhoods.
Good answer, John.
Oh, yeah, no. Come on, I've been a tech for so long. I'm really good at giving technically correct but deeply unsatisfying answers.
And I think you're right. In many ways, yes. In some ways, not.
Well, I mean, how do you quantify friendly?
Yeah.
So that's what you called it the friendly lab? No, not the friendly lab.
Friendly Cities Lab.
Friendly Cities Lab. But that really means something. That's just to make us listen, right? So. How do you put a number on friendly? Like, do you
Are
get a
you
friendly
asking for
score?
A metric, Ed?
I want
He's
a metric.
Immediately jumping in. He wants a metric.
No,
He's
just,
a physicist.
I'm sure there's a score, right? Because every city probably has a friendly score.
Well, that's not exactly how we want to synthesize everything. So quantifying friendly outside of the urban realm is a very interesting question. Now, some people do quantify relationships. interpersonal relationships of. One really popular example of that is John Gottman's lab at the University of Washington. And what he does is he's known for his love lab, where he's able to take video captures of people looking at their body language and predict with a very high level of certainty how their relationship is going to play out. There's other types of metrics using biofeedback and affective computing, people shifting around, eye contact, etc., to also quantify, you know, using electrical engineering properties, how this relationship is going, whether romantic, not, etc.
So by electrical engineering, we mean skin conductivity and
yeah,
things like that?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Right, oh, galvanic cool. skin response. Okay.
Yes, I remember the MIT Media Lab. In the news lately, maybe that's your story this week, Pete.
No, it's not, but it should be probably.
They had this glove that that they built and you could wear, and it had a little light on the back of it, and it would measure the conductivity in your skin, mm-hmm. which was a proxy for your arousal level. Mm-hmm. And so the light would just, and they were saying like if everyone wore these, it would be very interesting.
I think it'd be very weird. Right.
Well, arousal could be a lot of, not necessarily
yeah,
sexual
not necessarily,
arousal.
Right.
You could be like terrified, you're taking a test or something.
And I think you just get aroused when you get to attach electrodes to people's skin. I think that's really what does
is
it.
Is there something in Star Trek maybe that's
Well,
but so they actually do this in the marriage lab, the love lab? What was it?
I'm not sure if they use biofeedback the love lab, but I do know about more of the affective computing realm, and they do that definitely.
But really, that's what the Media Lab's doing now? Because I believe it was several decades ago, the guys who first started the gaming division at Nintendo came up with kind of the, you know, you used to see this as a game in arcades, the love tester, and it literally was testing.
Are you talking about the power glove?
It is so bad.
But I mean, this is from something from like 35 years
ago.
Yeah,
like the 1980s, Nintendo Power Glove.
Yeah, I'm reading.
I know the thing you're talking about. Yeah. It's like got the two handles. It would be an arcade cabinet, and you and the other person would
touch
hold
it, right.
the metal
And it would
thing.
Measure, you know, skin conductivity.
I always assumed that it just rolled dice behind the scenes and gave you a random fortune.
No, that's most of my research.
Two people, like one hold each?
No, I think you hold both of your hands.
Maybe that's where we went wrong.
There are two different versions of this.
We are getting way off topic here, guys.
All right, so let's continue the program with a segment we often start with.
Science in the news.
All right, and I hate to disappoint you, Ed. I did not pick an appropriate science.
Was that a bird?
That was the bee whisperer, Dr. Levy,
that was
I think.
Not me.
Isn't that you doing
that
the scream?
No, I think I stole that off the internet. That was probably just some random screen I took off the internet.
Is the bird okay?
Well, the person, I don't really know who did that. But
it might have been a bird.
Occasionally,
like a falcon.
When we can't, when we have to reproduce this, when we can't find that particular liner in the computer, Jennifer has stepped in.
I have screamed, yeah.
She does have a good scream. And I think it's her punk rock background coming through.
And I am trying to find the beginning of, I think I left the, oh. Wait,
is it about the size of the proton?
No, I thought about the size of the proton, but I thought, oh, my God. Talk about pedantic detail. Did you read that article?
Yeah, I did read it. It was kind of sad.
Why was it sad?
Oh, well, like 10 years ago, and I don't remember the name of the science. I'm really bad with names.
All right, 10 years ago, 0.88 femtometers.
Yeah, they were measuring the size of the proton, and instead of an electron, they put a muon going around,
right,
which is like a very heavy, like 1,000 times heavier than an electron.
Right. And it got smaller.
Yeah. And they were like, oh, my God, new physics. Whoa! You know, that's the thing that physics people get excited about.
Yeah, I believe it
about.
Went to 0.83 femtometers.
And so someone did a really better and careful experiment this year, mm-hmm. and they're like, no, it didn't get smaller. We just had a bad measure for the size of the proton.
Okay.
So no new physics.
It happens. But, so know. That's why it was sad. Well, the science in the news that I chose actually came from scienceinthenews.org by Maria Temming, implying that Silicon Valley may soon be a misnomer. So it turns out that the sun may be setting on silicon. Now computer chips made with carbon nanotubes are the up-and-comers. So they did actually make a functional series of transistors with carbon nanotubes. Doesn't work as well. Don't have billions and millions of transistors yet. Isn't quite as fast because they're worried about the interface
and
things
like that. 10,000 tubes or something, right?
Yeah, which is pretty small compared to
like billions.
Typical, yeah, microprocessor. The prototype described in an August 29th issue of Nature is not yet speedy or as small as the commercial silicon devices, but carbon nanotube computer chips may ultimately give rise to a new generation of faster, more energy-efficient electronics. So it takes advantage of the fact that sort of flat conjugated carbon, like graphene, which we can form as a flat arrangement or in tubes or all sorts of interesting things. You can put it in a sphere, things like that, have the interesting semiconductor properties, so we don't have to dope silicon anymore. And this may be the future of silicon chips.
Oh, so it's more of a...
silicon chips.
Or sorry, of microprocessors.
So it's a shape-based thing more than it's a dopant-based thing now?
Well, you can actually chemically modify carbon nanotubes and things like that. So you can do the equivalent of doping as well. But if we got into the details, it would take 3.5 hours to talk about carbon nanotubes and how they actually work. But actually...
I guess this isn't a show exclusively for me and things I find interesting.
Well, so I think it's nice that we've been talking about this for decades, right? And I work in photoresists and silicon and things like that. And all these folks that walk around saying, well, dude, in another year, my cell phone's going to be twice as fast, right? Because of who's the former president of Intel?
Moore's Law.
Moore's Law, right. So Gordon Moore. Moore's Law is bumping up into kind of a brick wall. So it would be nice to have other technology such as this sort of thing. And I do want to mention that the corresponding author is Max Schulacher, and Gage Hills is the first author of a number of people who actually just published this in August. I'm actually looking at the paper talking about electronics approaching a major paradigm shift because silicon transistor scaling no longer yields historical energy energy efficiency benefits. And we're hoping that in the future we're going to be making them out of this. So maybe the era of cell phones and computers getting so much faster every year, basically doubling every 18 months to 2 years, is not over. I was afraid it was, if you look at normal silicon. So this is a big deal for people that are addicted to their cell phone.
Or doing machine learning.
Yeah.
Yeah? You need some high-power computing for your work.
So do you use a lot of high-power computing for your work?
Yeah.
Yeah, we're looking at you.
Yeah, we know.
You're back to me.
Yeah,
yes, we're back to you.
Right. You are always on.
Great. Well, I was just thinking about carbon nanotubes, so my mind started wandering.
Well, good. That's a plus for this show.
Sure. Yeah. We used machine learning in a very recent study using Airbnb images. Ooh. So we scraped a ton of interiors from Airbnb using their API, and we downloaded millions of photos from all over the world. And we used a package in TensorFlow that used image processing, and it was able to detect in the images where plants were, where books were, and then we trained it to detect art, wall art, mm-hmm. and decor. And
now is the goal to have a machine that can judge me for my interior design?
You are likely a poor college student.
It did not judge anybody. It just counted things. You didn't need machine learning for this, but it also was able to pick up predominant colors in the different images. And so we did this for all over the world, and we only did it for living rooms. We decided after we downloaded all the data that the bathrooms weren't as interesting, and the bedrooms were not as interesting either. But the living rooms we thought were really cool.
So what do you do with that kind of data in this project?
We geocoded all of the Airbnb places into 100 and some different cities, like 110 different cities. And so for all over the world, we counted up, you know, where the interiors had plants in them, where the interiors had books, what interiors were using vibrant colors, etc. So we found out that the most vibrant colors in the world were in Morocco and in India. We found out that plants were the most prevalent in Scandinavia and in China. We found out that there were a ton of books in the U.S. and in Europe, mostly. Those were a lot of where the books were. We had originally hypothesized that there'd be a lot of plants in tropical areas, like in Africa and the Caribbean, etc., but we didn't find any plants indoors there, or we found very few. And
there's enough outside.
Yeah, that was their answer. They're like, well, we have plants everywhere. Why would we put them indoors?
So were there like more plants in Arizona or New Mexico?
We didn't have that kind of granularity of cities. When we did it all over the world, we kind of took some of the top cities.
Oh, okay.
So we didn't get down to New Mexico. Mm-hmm. But within the U.S., we did a deep dive into a few cities, and we did it by neighborhood. And our original question was, are neighborhoods of various income levels, do they decorate differently? Mm-hmm. And we found out that no. That
interesting.
That these neighborhoods that... Airbnbs in neighborhoods that were lower income had the same amount of art, had the same amount of plants, had the same amount of decor as in other parts of the city. And this is a good time to say that we only used Airbnbs where you could rent one room in the place. So they weren't Airbnbs that were set up to completely get the whole place.
The whole house, the whole apartment.
Yeah, you're not allowed to have the whole apartment, the whole house. It is you're allowed to rent a room. So ostensibly, somebody lives there.
So as someone who just booked an Airbnb in Florida over the upcoming year-end break, what does this tell me? Are there places I should go on vacation? I shouldn't go on vacation?
I would go to Morocco.
Okay, cool.
Wow. You like vibrant colors?
Or India. Yeah, I like the vibrant colors.
So wait, how does the amount of like vibrant colors and the amount of artwork or whatever you see like based in the Airbnbs, if you still see it in the same amounts in low-income neighborhoods and higher-income neighborhoods, how do you see that as like a friendlier city kind of?
Well, they don't always relate back to the name of the research lab, but we're often used to seeing maps of our cities in terms of how segregated they are and saying this is this part of the city, this is that part of the city. But it's really interesting to know that when you look at the individual and how the individual is caring for their interior, that we're all very similar in that regard. So it's something that unifies us across the neighborhoods instead of dividing us.
Oh, cool. Wow. Mm.
So that's nice.
That does tell me something important because I'm, how do I describe this? Cheap. so I don't normally rent Airbnbs in the fancier parts of town. And what you're telling me is I can probably expect a similar level of decoration and the quality of the room no matter where I go.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Wow. Mm-hmm. So it's good for me. So when my wife and my kids are like, well, this is kind of a dumpy neighborhood. Why'd you book it here? Now I have more of them. And before we move on, let me remind you that basically our job as hosts is to crack cheap jokes in between and have you define words. So scraped a ton of interiors. So scraping is not something, well, I guess it might be something your podiatrist does occasionally from time to time. But you're talking about extracting data from the Applications Programming Interface, the API.
That's right.
At Airbnb. Okay. So do you do everything through an API? Because I do have a few students who occasionally... just go in and grab the data without using the Applications Programming Interface. And then they get a letter 3 months later saying, stop messing with our data. So is that typically how you guys get data?
Yes, okay. It is. There are definitely times where we wrote a web scraper by ourselves. We have one project where getting the data was a total nightmare. Mm-hmm. And that was when we were using NCAA data to understand more about where athletes come from. Mm-hmm. So we had talked to the NCAA and said, hey, you know, we really want to do this cool project. You have such a vibrant research outreach webpage, and you have a lot of great research that you sponsor on concussions. You have research that you sponsor on how athletes get higher grades and how they build team building skills, etc. It's like, well, we want to show that NCAA athletes actually add more diversity to colleges because they come internationally, they come from other parts of the country, etc.
Right.
We did not get the data that we wanted from them.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh. That's okay. So we went out and we just cut and pasted it ourselves. 160,000 athletes. I paid my little sister to help. Found some Mechanical Turkers to help. And then sometimes at night we would just go and cut and paste. And that sounds very silly, but these rosters across colleges were HTML, if we were lucky, PDFs sometimes, PHP, Flash. I mean, it was a wild west of angry data.
Okay, so we just got an alphabet soup of basically data storage formats.
So it wasn't consistent.
Right.
Sometimes you could easily copy-paste. Sometimes I'm guessing you had to go in and visually
retype. Read it. And type it.
Yes.
Wow. So what? So what? Why did the NCAA not want to give you that data?
I don't know.
Did they say why?
No. I think they said they didn't have it, which I was like, that's not true.
But it's available publicly on their websites, right? I mean, it's out there. If you could cut and paste it.
Yes, it is. It's just distributed across every college's website.
Oh, so they don't have it in a consistent, systematic form where you can just grab
Maybe.
The data.
They didn't share it in a consistent, systematic form.
And what did you find with all this data?
Well, we were able to geolocate every athlete's hometown and what sport they were, gender, and where they went to school. So we were able to find out the schools that had the highest, quote, pull power. So what universities were able to attract athletes from the most distant and diverse locales. And the ones that popped up on the top of our list were Stanford, MIT, University of Arizona, University of Idaho, schools that were in the West Coast, or some of the more high-ranked academically private schools. So the ones that were at the bottom of our list, so they attracted the most local students, which isn't a bad thing to attract local students. It's just, it was a difference. Mm-hmm. Were Rutgers, UMBC, which is Maryland, Baltimore County, University of Chicago, or University of Illinois at Chicago, Temple, Drexel, Duquesne. So schools that had a lot of Catholic university, schools that were in cities and could attract a lot of students from nearby. For example, the average distance of the Rutgers baseball team was like 50 kilometers away.
Hmm. Wow.
So, yeah.
They probably grew up knowing each other.
They probably grew up knowing each other.
Little league teams and things.
Yeah. But the average distance of like the University of Washington tennis team was over 5,000 kilometers. Like they were from all over the place.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. So I'm kind of curious, MIT drew diverse athletes?
Yes. So it doesn't necessarily mean that these athletes are on scholarship. It's
okay.
Just who's playing sports
okay.
there.
Who goes there to play a particular sport.
Exactly.
And obviously this is not NCAA Division I.
Not all of them. We got all the Division I teams, but then we added in some other ones.
Okay. Okay.
Did you have any control for the student population overall at those universities?
It didn't correlate with the size, and it didn't correlate with the amount of funding they give to athletics either.
Okay. Or rankings?
No.
Other than the few?
It didn't correlate mm-hmm. with that. No. The things that it correlated with were whether they were in the whether they had
West Coast.
Yeah, West Coast, and then private schools were a bit higher. But what we found regionally in the whole world was that, and this isn't exactly super surprising, but that a lot of Muslim countries didn't send female athletes. Mm-hmm. We found that there's a lot of golfers in Thailand. We got a lot of golfers.
Oh, I did not know that.
We found that a lot of track and field athletes from the Caribbean. Mm-hmm. We found a lot of ice hockey players from Canada.
Oh, Canada.
Very few Mexican athletes and very, very few
Chinese athletes overall. Wow.
Very few Chinese athletes. Hmm. Like a pocketful. And given how many students we have here and from China, the number of athletes was tiny.
Hmm. Weird that it isn't proportional.
It was not proportional at all. We got a lot of rowers from the UK, from Australia. We have a lot of field hockey players from the Netherlands and Germany. Mm-hmm. A lot of swimmers and divers from Singapore and Japan.
Mm-hmm. Wow. But we don't really play much field hockey here, do we? It's mainly Europe. They're big on field hockey. Mm. In fact, don't we just make fun of field hockey here in the United States?
I mean, as someone from North Dakota, I make fun of hockey players all the time.
One difference in the U.S. is that we don't do male field hockey.
Yes, that's true.
Hockey.
I mean, most Americans, if you ask them field hockey, they think it's people waving an upside down cane. They don't really, when they watch it, they're like, what is that? I don't think they've ever seen it before.
Is that different from lacrosse?
Oh, very
much
yes. different.
Separate sports? I don't
yes,
know.
They're different
you,
sports.
You sustain just as many injuries to the shins, though, based on my personal experience. So do these athletes make universities more diverse?
That was the takeaway that from our article. It wasn't what we said in the article. There's not a lot of saying diversity with a capital D.
Right.
Because we don't really know how the athletes, if they go there, if you're an athlete coming from Kenya, like, are you making your, are you interacting with your university in a way that increases diversity? I don't know the particulars of that. Mm-hmm. But the fact that you're there in Idaho is kind of interesting.
Was your diversity based on, like, distance or more on race and, like, nationality?
Diversity was actually just variety. So if your school was able to attract students from many different cities and many different countries around the world.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you're currently doing some work on romance and the built environment.
Yeah.
What is that? And what's the deal with that project?
Well, we want urban planners to pay attention to how the city can help romantic relationships. There's a lot of separation these days. There's a lot of dating that's online. And we want the built environment, things that you can see, to be helpful for relationships. And as things like movie theaters are becoming less popular, or online dating becomes the way that people are chatting and meeting each other, the actual brick and mortar institutions may start to have a different role in dating and romance. So we are trying to do some studies to see how city planners can help romance, love in the city.
Now, that is not a connection I would have thought to make. So you mentioned things like movie theaters. Is it places to go on dates? Is it encouraging places to meet people?
Both.
Okay.
Yeah. And so we have done one study, and that was in State College. We did a survey of over 100 couples, and we asked them about how the city supports their relationship and where they made their strongest memories and what it could do better. So what we found, which was really interesting, is they made some of their strongest memories outdoors. So they said hiking, going to the park, places where they were picnicking or at the beach or just walking around was really important to mm-hmm. them. And we weren't shocked, but we didn't have that at the forefront at the beginning. We also found that nightclubs were not important for couples. They didn't like that, the nightclubs. Religious institutions didn't pop up as a big thing. Hanging out with at friends' houses also didn't pop up as much.
Oh, that's surprising.
Yeah. A lot of restaurants, a lot of drinking.
Do you think that would be different if it was like a big city like Atlanta or New York?
We are going to recreate this in Atlanta for sure, this type of survey, because in State College, you know, we don't have an aquarium. We don't have certain amenities that we would like to retest.
How about something like the nightclub, for instance? Do you think that would be different, even that specifically, be like a completely opposite like reaction in a bigger city?
I can't wait to find out. Okay. I'm really interested in finding that out.
So I'm very interested in what you might do with a big city like Atlanta, because if you look at things like the aquarium, science museums, big venues like that, that now has been turned into a social interaction type venue. I did a gig at the Carnegie Science Center in Pittsburgh, and it was a stay up all night gig for adults, which was, people brought sleeping bags, they slept in the museum. And I went out at like 11:30 at night and did an hour of nerd comedy, but they were drinking, there was a bar, there was food.
Could you go in the exhibits?
I did see the exhibits.
You actually can sleep over at the aquarium.
Yeah, you can. So that's what I'm saying. So they do this now. And to me, this is so weird because I met my wife on a dating service. It was before the internet, so they actually snail mailed you a phone number every week. But still, it was like...
Is that true?
That is true.
Did you do the video? Was it a VHS?
I did not do the video. So this was you. Actually, they were very good, and you might find this interesting. I'm sure they're out of business now because it's all on the internet now. It was called Together, and you would go in and literally take a Scantron battery of tests, probably 100 or 200 questions. And I believe they would do, a covariance matrix and do some principal component analysis and try to figure things out. And the way they got you to sign up is they recruited very attractive people, both men and women. Mm. So I was a postdoc at IBM in California. I could not meet women to save my life. And I couldn't even find guys that I worked with to act as a wingman to go out and try to meet women because they were all either married or bigger nerds than I was. So the woman who finally convinced me to sign up for it looked like Heather Locklear. And I'm like, okay, who do I write the check out to? And that's how I met my wife. So I don't think that's bad, but I think you're right. I find it a little bit disconcerting that people don't interact face-to-face anymore. And I think it'd be nice if we did that more. Because I don't think you can really get to know someone.
Well, you just told us you met your wife over the phone.
Well, but here's the deal. This is just cold a screening called her. Process. You're like, no, I did not.
Did you sign up for a dating service? My name's Pete.
I had met four women before my wife, and she was the first one to call me first.
Oh.
And we ended up getting married. So we've been married for 26 years.
Where did you go on your first date?
We went to, oh my God, this is embarrassing. We went to a restaurant that I got lost going to, and this is before geographic information systems and GPS. I had a map
on the back of an envelope.
This was even before MapQuest. I literally had a Rand McNally map of Boston. I was an hour late.
Oh.
And when I got
there. She waited?
She waited.
Wow.
And she proceeded to have the woman next to her chew me out for being an hour late. And the woman next to her can only be generously described as a bar fly. She smelled like alcohol. And, yeah, so it all worked out in the end. But let me ask you a question. Back in the days before the crust of the earth cooled, we depended on very different venues. So you're right. I think movie theaters are waning. I don't even like the modern movie theaters because you get that reclining chair and people my age just fall asleep on Friday.
People take their shoes off. That's gross.
Mm-hmm. Really?
They do.
I do that on airline flights. You must
That's noticed. Gross, too.
Oh, my God. It's a 15-hour flight to Dubai. My feet are going to swell. But in any case, we had something called drive-in movies that were basically the modern rent-by-the-hour hotel.
No.
Yeah, they were. There was more
like make-out point.
Physical intimacy going on at drive-in movie theaters.
Well, there's still drive-in movie theaters.
Yeah, Atlanta has one.
Do we?
Yeah. Yes, we have a very popular.
State College has one.
I didn't know that.
Very, very popular drive-in theater here. The Starlight.
I did not know
that. I actually want to know this.
We're not judging here. Go ahead.
Okay, all right. So I have a question. I have an actual research question. So I'm concerned about how if there's autonomous vehicles and people, there's self-driving cars. If there's two people in a car, self-driving car on the highway, is there anything we need to worry about?
The answer is yes, based on the discussion in my startup lab class the other day. So these guys are doing startup innovative ideas, and one of the groups is going to pivot away from a device that monitors your alertness and will, you know, shake you or shock you or do something if you're falling asleep. And we talked about autonomous vehicles. What they will do is they'll self-drive, but every 10 minutes, they will query you, are you still driving? Are you still awake? And they'll, you know, ask you to put your hand
back
on the
screen. So you get 10 minutes.
And I don't know whether it's 5 minutes or... It's kind of like, so I've been binge-watching Netflix recently. You'll watch through three of them, and it'll say, are you still watching GLOW, the Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling? And it'll ask you to put an input in to tell you that. So, yeah, I think it's going to query you every once in a while. Are we talking about people knocking boots in a car driving down the highway? Is that what we're...
I mean, that's been happening since we've had cars, right?
So. But not while you're driving, right?
Not with that.
I mean, we pull into a drive-in movie theater or... What is it? You go by the lake or something? Isn't that
Oh, my gosh. Can we change subjects, please?
There's going to be a lot of weird things we have to regulate.
I think
once
autonomous vehicles
cars.
Will change a lot of things.
Some for the good.
Probably dating, too.
Actually,
maybe you could date somebody farther away.
I was about to ask that because in Atlanta, if you don't have a car, that really limits the number of places you can go.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, MARTA is really great for going east and west and north and south, but that's about it.
Mm-hmm. We have the bird scooter. You can show up to your date on a bird.
That is a very good, hey, I am this cool.
I've seen two people on the scooters lately. So
what?
They've done the tandem
riding.
Yeah.
Tandem bird?
Yeah.
It's a very romantic because it'll make your heart flutter because you're not sure if you're going to die on the next bump in the road.
I was late. I took a Lime scooter here today. But this morning when I walked out of my parking garage, there was an ambulance from Grady there. There was a bicycle collision. Mm. And they were all right. It was superficial injuries. But, yeah, the cop was there and they were bandaging, putting some bandages on.
Do you have access to any dating data? Can you, scrape data from Tinder or something?
That's a good question. What we're working with right now is Craigslist data. Yikes. So we're not working with any data companies. Yikes is a really big, great word.
Okay, why is yikes? I use Craigslist all the time. Why is yikes?
Really? To meet people?
No, not to meet people, but to buy and sell stuff and look for games.
Yeah, this isn't, we're not looking at bike sales. Okay. so there's a section in Craigslist called Missed Connections, where people go in and they say, hey, I saw you at this place and you looked at me or we had this conversation, message me if you want to hang out, stuff like that. And we're interested in that, in the place.
Mm-hmm.
So where are these places? So it differs by where you are. In the South, it tends to be a lot of Walmart. Saw you at Walmart. In Las Vegas, it tends to be casino. In New York, it tends to be the subway. So it just depends on the context of the built environment where you're meeting these people. And so we don't know if these relationships actually materialize, but it's really interesting to think about how we've built our space to allow this to happen or to prevent it from happening.
Wow. And can you work with people in urban planning and architecture to find out why is it we have misconnections in Walmart? Is there something interesting about Walmart?
Well, there's nowhere to talk, right?
There's nowhere else you see people.
Well, but it's missed connections, right? So if you don't see it at Publix, maybe it's because Publix has tables out front mm-hmm. where you could talk to the person for longer and then it wouldn't be a missed connection. It would have been a made connection.
That's a good point, too. Mm-hmm. Yes. I think that is true. And we're also a little reluctant to just swoop in and be like, hey, hang out with me, stranger.
Yeah. I see you're buying light bulbs.
Yeah. Yes.
I like light bulbs, too.
I was going to ask if you were vegetarian, but here we are at the meat counter.
So why is that so yikes, though? Misconnections? That sounds relatively innocent. Sometimes you see someone.
After the show, Pete, do a little deep dive into the Atlanta Craigslist misconnections.
So it gets a little...
If you want to get really crazy, go to Activity Partners. Missed Connections is PG-13.
Okay,
plus
so that's relatively innocent.
Yeah, Activity Partners, sometimes on Activity Partners, you will get actual activities like, I'm a senior retiree and I would like someone to take a walk with. Sometimes the other Activity Partners have a lot of doublespeak in them.
Oh... So a lot of weird stuff. Like I saw at Dragon Con this past weekend.
Yes.
Role-playing,
there
weird
were misconnections
costumes.
From Dragon Con on there. Oh, saw I bet. You at Dragon oh. Con.
Oh, okay.
You were interested in whatever.
Okay. I understand. I'm thinking, you could find tennis partners, but apparently...
You can find tennis partners. Okay. You just need to... Be very clear that you are looking for a tennis partner.
And tennis means tennis.
And tennis right. means tennis.
So tennis isn't something weird I have to look up on the Urban Dictionary and figure out what the heck is going on.
Yes.
Wow.
How about places like Tinder? Are there hashtags, like a first date hashtag or something you could use to pull images maybe or tweets or something? I don't know.
Tinder has a serious lack of text.
Twitter.
Twitter. Oh, Twitter, absolutely. We haven't gotten too far into Twitter, down into Twitter yet for this particular thing. Twitter's really helpful for other types of relationships, took my daughter to see the Mets game or something like that. So for family relationships, professional relationships, conferences, etc., but not as much for romance that I've noticed. Yet.
Wow. So you also mentioned that you have a partnership with Big Brothers and Big Sisters.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me about that project.
We love working with Big Brothers, Big Sisters. So Big Brothers, Big Sisters is a mentorship program in the U.S. that is responsible for well over 1 million partnerships. They've been around since the early 1900s. And what they do is they pair a grown-up volunteer with a youth And usually it's male, male, female, female. Mm-hmm. But now there's so many boys on the waiting list to get a big brother that they'll often have a big sister now. Mm-hmm. And so we were interested in the geographic layout of these relationships. So are these relationships bridging neighborhoods that look quite segregated or look quite different on a map? Mm-hmm. And we found out that indeed they are. So we have a lot of lines on a map now where it shows where the big lives and where the little lives. And they tend to bridge these very disparate relationships. So we thought that they were going to be very distant and kind of connect the whole city like a big star. Mm-hmm. But instead, they were very close together. But the difference in the racial composition of the neighborhoods was very, very stark. Mm-hmm. We had also thought that we were going to get a lot of bigs from the suburbs. We were thinking empty nesters, but it turns out that a lot of the urbanites, so people who live downtown, and a lot of millennials were mostly comprising the big brothers and the big sisters. So that desire to be part of the urban fabric instead of being more isolating yourself really in the suburbs, mm-hmm. People were really putting their money where their mouth is and were also volunteering, which is great.
So does that say something about the typical demographic makeup of suburbs? Are these people that sort of want to get out of the complicated ties of the city?
That was certainly true in the 50s and the 60s with white flight. Mm-hmm. Today, there's been some articles where they say that they're really reaping what they sowed and that a lot of elderly people in the suburbs are now very isolated. It's hard for them to get around. It's hard for them to access venues and groceries and et cetera, because of this, because they forfeited their accessibility, because they didn't want public transportation. And so now that's where they live. But I don't have actual data on that, so I can't comment definitively.
When you say that the neighborhoods are being bridged between like higher income neighborhoods, lower mm-hmm. income neighborhoods, do you see like the big brother, little brother relationship going both ways? Like little
yes.
brothers from higher income neighborhoods with big brothers from lower income neighborhoods?
Oh, not as much. Not very frequently, no. But in terms of the relationship going both ways, it does go both ways in that it really does help the big as well. They're really invited into the homes of the little. They get to meet the family, be part of social networks, whether that's like family picnics, family reunions, quinceañeras. And so they really learn a lot about that neighborhood and the life there. There's also a new program called Bigs in Blue, and that pairs police officers with littles in really tough neighborhoods. So the police officers can better understand what the little goes through, the dangers that he or she faces, more about being scared about gun violence, et cetera.
Wow, that's really cool.
I'm just surprised it's still around. I hadn't even heard someone mention big brothers or sisters in.
I see their ads.
It's thriving,
like 10 years or so.
For sure.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah. But they need bigs. They need big males. So
Ed is a big male. We've established that in kinematics on a regular basis.
Three littles I'm already taking care of. I think that might be why you don't see the suburbs, is you got a lot of families up there and people are oversubscribed.
Actually, I have a little. He's 19 years old, and he's actually quite big. And he's actually bigger than you, Ed. So
he could be a big.
He could be a big. I'm not sure he's ready for that, but I'll keep that in mind. So basically, we're a bunch of deadbeats. We need to get involved in big brothers, big sisters.
It is interesting that you mentioned that it's more popular with millennials, mm-hmm. and certainly I can see a logic to that where me, I cannot have a child, but occasional things that are like parenting and very supportive, but not to the same level of that. No, yeah, that makes a lot more sense. It's a lot more approachable.
Yes, yes.
I was, like a week ago, I said to one of my daughters something like, oh, we'll just MacGyver it. And they didn't know what I was talking about. They had never...
Have
you guys heard of MacGyver?
Because the first episode, it's him and his little.
Yeah, he has a little. Wow, good memory.
MacGyver has a little?
So I was. They were like, what's MacGyver? And I was like,
the reason
why I'm a scientist. and so I found it on Hulu or Amazon Prime or something. And we watched the first two episodes.
They actually did a remake of that show. And I think a majority of it was actually filmed in Atlanta.
Yeah, really cool. There's a new version.
Yeah. Look at that.
And then there's a parody called MacGruber that got
made
into a film.
Yes, I remember MacGruber from Saturday Night Live. But in the original, MacGyver is a big, and he has a little. And I remember thinking, like, that kid lucked out. Because, like, MacGyver lives in, like, an abandoned observatory.
The coolest spot.
Yeah, so he's, like, showing the kid how to, like, get in the seat and work the giant telescope.
Wow.
And I'm like, cool. Wow, imagine if MacGyver was your big.
All right, at this point in the program, I need to apologize. We've been so riveted by the research we've been talking about here. I have not mentioned that if you've got a question or comment about this fascinating juxtaposition of sort of geography and geolocation on interesting social data, and you want to give us a call here live in the studio, particularly if you're listening live, September 11th. Yeah, I didn't realize that was today. 2019. By all means, give us a call here at the studio at 404-894-2468. Once again, that number, 404-894-2468. And we were talking about Twitter a little while ago. I don't even think we tweet stuff out anymore because most of our listening audience is driving at the time.
Yeah, we're all about not checking your phone while you're driving. And that's something we stand by.
So pull over.
Autonomous vehicles, that's going to be different, I guess.
And give us a call or if you've got a question or a comment for Dr. Andrus about this fascinating area of research.
Well, I have a question. Is there like a large data set somewhere that you would really like to get a hold of that you've never been able to have access to?
That exists or that we want to make?
No, that exists. Like, if you could get into...
if it's a matter of accessibility.
Yeah, like, if there's something out and you're like, oh, we could do a lot if we could just convince the NCAA folks have that data. Is there, like, some data set out there that you know it's there and you could answer some really interesting questions if you could get a hold of it?
The Uber data would be pretty cool to have. That would be really interesting to have Uber data.
Yeah.
There's some out there. And then we have taxi trips. But in a different way, to know more about the linked, we can get trips, individual trips, but we don't know if one person is taking those multiple trips, et cetera. That would be really interesting. And the dating stuff that you were talking about, for sure, like OkCupid data or Tinder data, like that would be fascinating.
Yeah, I remember the OkCupid guy. I don't know his name, but he sometimes does a little data analysis, right? And
the OkCupid blog is fantastic.
Yes.
I think his name was Chris something, but they showed it to Match.com
rather
recently, and I don't really know the deal with that, but their blog is great. Really, really great. My favorite blog.
This is the OkCupid blog?
Mm-hmm.
The guy who founded OkCupid.
You read the OkCupid blog?
No, I don't troll OkCupid, Pete. But I do enjoy a subreddit on Reddit called Data is Beautiful.
And oftentimes, cool. Oh, I gotta look that up.
The guy who wrote the blog for OkCupid would produce some beautiful plots. Data.
Yeah.
And he would share it there. So that's how I started following the OkCupid blog.
But could you talk to Match.com or what's the really big one? With the old guy.
What's the one you always see in the back of like Science and Nature?
Yeah, eHarmony.
For scientists, right? Isn't there the...
They have a dating service for scientists?
Yes. There's like a guy with a mouse or something.
Really?
And like a test tube and a little mouse is on the... Yes.
Nerds meeting nerds? Is that what it's called?
Maybe that's only in Physics Today, the back of the physics one, yeah.
Wow.
I don't remember what it's called. I don't know. But yeah, it's a scientist meeting. It's a scientist dating service.
That's so interesting.
I searched Physics Today dating, and I don't know what I expected, because it's all about carbon dating.
Those pesky isotopes always getting in the way. So let me ask you. So to me, this is absolutely fascinating. The idea of, you know, as you talk about geolocating and things like that. So look at geographic distributions of data and correlations and things like this. What's the ultimate goal for analyzing data like this? I mean, so you learn a lot about how athletes provide diversity and how people interact in cities. And you can use them to maybe redesign open spaces, public spaces. Is that the goal, to redesign our cities based on this stuff? Or is there a bigger goal?
Redesigning cities is a big goal. For example, like the North Avenue MARTA station is now being completely redesigned. And us being able to go in and say, you know, what kind of amenities should you have here? You might want to have like chess boards so people can come and meet and play chess. You might want to have a heads up display for people who are on the streets if they need to find out what shelters are full or where they could get free food today, things like that. So instead of just configuring things from a architectural standpoint, what kinds of things can we add on to these types of social public places mm-hmm. to make it easier to live in the city or to make the city respond to the people a little bit better? Wow. So that is a huge goal. And sometimes you think, well, that should be a no-brainer that you'd want to put seating out somewhere. But it doesn't happen as much as it could.
Right.
And certainly there's a push towards hostile architecture in cities to discourage yes. Homeless people a lot of the time, or to discourage skateboarders yes. a lot of the time, too.
Or pigeons or whatever.
Or
it
scooter
is
riders. There's that ban on nighttime riding.
Although I think they just shut down the app for that one.
Oh, did they?
I'm guessing.
Yeah,
I think it's easier.
I think they just turned it off at night now. But that's just an Atlanta thing. I got to tell you, I got home from the airport, and I never drive to the airport anymore. I take MARTA in because it is, you're right, it's maybe tough to meet people going in across east and west and north and south. But to the airport, there's nothing better. So I got back, and I've got that last mile to Tech to get my car, where I usually park it here and then drive home. Or sometimes I take MARTA all the way home and have somebody pick me up. But I have figured out how to balance a carry-on suitcase on a scooter, which I do not recommend. But I got back at 10 o'clock at night. I took the late flight back from New York, and I couldn't make it. So I had to walk and wear out the wheels on my suitcase.
I had to do that once, and I noticed that bridge on the 5th Street Bridge.
Uh-huh.
And maybe this is something like data would illuminate, but...
The bricks drive you nuts?
No, no. Normally in the day, you go over to Tech Square, you cross that 5th Street Bridge, and there's like nobody there, or maybe like somebody there from PETA or someone trying to get you to sign a petition.
Yeah.
And it's just kind of empty, but it's really big, right? They put in this huge green space.
Oh, it's very nice, actually.
Pergolas and everything.
And it's got the overhang with like the vines on
yes.
it. It's gorgeous.
But it's empty, which I always thought was weird. And then one night I caught a flight back. And I was walking back to the physics building at like 9:30 at night. And there were a ton of students there hanging out. They were like playing Frisbee and like someone had a stereo or something. And I was like, oh, my God, this space does have a use. I just never saw it and knew it.
I occasionally see a little Frisbee going on over there.
Yeah, so maybe you could – maybe that would be an interesting thing if you could find like hidden usage of resources mm-hmm. where it looks like – to most people who are like 9-to-5ers, that it's never being utilized, but it has this other purpose than tons of people show up there mm-hmm. at a random hour or something.
Yeah.
So, no, I'm trying to remember the question I was going to ask.
I had something I was thinking about, actually. So I've noticed, like, Atlanta in general, just, like, the downtown area never seems super crowded unless, like, something huge is going on. Is there something that could be done to, like, work with changing that? Because I know, like, New York or Chicago, it's never like that. It's always, like, crowded on the weekends if you're downtown, but it's never really the case in Atlanta.
A lot of cities have that problem. Houston has that problem. Phoenix has that problem. We know how it came about. Mm-hmm. What needs to happen is that there needs to be more residential downtown. So people go down there and they live there, and then more mixed use, just making it more like the things that we have in these, what we call a polycentric city, which this Atlanta is a polycentric mm-hmm. city. And so making that downtown more at that scale of these, like the Virginia Highlands of the areas or the Buckheads of the areas where people are out at night, instead of making it just those 9-to-5 office
yeah.
buildings. I don't know if that's ever going to happen.
Well, they sure have been trying at Underground
yeah,
Atlanta.
They're moving
for like 30
in that
years.
Direction.
Yeah.
So with the Beltline project, I have friends that are moving back in. They're telling me I should move back in. And people, so I spent a lot of time doing study abroad programs in London. And when you can walk to work and walk to places you need to go to, that's a very satisfying lifestyle. To not have to get in a car and drive 35 minutes to go to someplace. So,
oh yeah, and over the summer I worked in Japan and. Just the sheer breadth of the metro stations was incredible because
mm-hmm.
I could go to work on the metro. I could meet friends on the metro. It was always yeah. inexpensive. And
yeah. Boston, New York, and Chicago, you can reach just about any place on their subway system. So here, not so much. We have this big cross that goes to the city. And if you live in the upper and lower quadrants, you're just out of luck. So, wow, that's amazing. So we've reached the portion of the program we like to call What Have We Learned? And we have learned a ton. And so not only just about individual projects. I think we've learned about the power of data. And is it fair to say that if you're going to redesign things or get designers and architects to design stuff, the way to motivate them to do it and the way to motivate city councils and governments to pay for it is to show them the data and say, look, if you had more of this, you'd have more interaction. It would be a better place. Is that a fair statement?
I think there's a lot of layers of politics.
Okay.
But
will data eventually help us?
Are you looking at me?
I'm looking at both you guys.
I think you can at least be right.
Yeah.
And it's not a guarantee, but it sure helps. Yeah.
Particularly here. We have our own set of politics.
I don't think you don't like consult with government, like community groups and things, do you? Right? You're just doing your research and publishing it, and whoever sees it, right? Is there like a planning stage where people like contact folks like you and ask you to perform an analysis?
I'm still unpacking my boxes, and I just got here.
You haven't fixed our city yet?
Not
Come on.
Yet.
So, but what we have learned is that there's a lot of fascinating patterns and connections that are being explored by your lab right now, and hopefully will be explored more in the future. Everything from Airbnb and basically Morocco, if you like colorful interiors, is where you ought to be going. I also learned that a cheap guy like me who tends to get Airbnb rentals in places that maybe aren't the fanciest neighborhoods, I can still expect a reasonable level of decoration of the rooms, which is good to know. So I'm pleased by that. A lot of interesting things about college athletes and diversity, where they come from, and what draws them there as well. I had no idea there were that many golfers in Thailand, so that was interesting for me. And, interesting things about relationships, how people meet, how they connect, how they can spend time together, that I was not aware of something that you could really design this way. And hopefully, you know, urban planners and architects and people will take this into account in the future. Interesting stuff about Big Brothers and Big Sisters. Ed was not even aware that program still existed. And if you are someone thinking about being a Big Brother, Ed, we should get off our butts and do this. They do need folks to do that. And the program you mentioned about Bigs in Blue, I tried to get you to do this, Ed, and Dylan, too. We did a motorcycle ride for charity with the Cobb County Police a little while ago. That would be a great way to get information flowing in both directions, not only for young kids who could benefit from talking with an older adult, but older adults who would learn something about the diverse nature of their community, and police officers would learn a little bit more about the community that they are actually assigned to. So hopefully all this interesting data and its juxtaposition over geolocating and geography and things like that will give us the information to redesign cities for the future. This was really fascinating.
Thank you. And I would just like to say I really enjoyed being on this show. And I have a lot of colleagues in architecture and urban planning who are knee deep in these initiatives, and love to check that out.
We would love to have them on the program. So we do appreciate you having you here. And if you're one of our regular listeners and you've got a question or comment or a suggestion for a future show here on Inside the Black Box, by all means, send us an email at comments@insidetheblackbox.org. We are a production of the WREK Studios here on the campus of the Georgia Institute of Technology. Our theme music is composed and performed by Bill and Mary Hunt, and we hope you join us next week for Inside the Black Box, Science Only Funnier.